Welcome to Heart with Keisha B., the podcast that focuses on the journey of grief, healing, and overcoming unforeseen circumstances. Whether you're dealing with loss or life challenges, this is a podcast that you don't want to miss. I am your host, Keisha B. So take a deep breath, open your mind and your soul, and sit back as we embark on this journey together. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another week of Heart to Heart with Keisha B. As you all know, for the past few weeks on Sundays, I've done bonus episodes, and this is another opportunity for me to have a bonus episode. So like always, I'm not going to get started yet because I know that we have some people out there that are trying to get into this live today. And so we're going to be patient, right? We're going to be patient on this Sunday and give you an opportunity to join our live today. And as you are joining, make sure to let somebody else know to also join. You can join by Facebook. If you're joining by the YouTube channel today, I'm going to ask you to like, subscribe, so that you can continue to be notified as every week we drop a new episode. So again, we're going to give everybody a few more minutes to join in on this live episode today. I don't know where you are, but I know here in West Virginia, it's snowing. So we are sort of snowed in. So what better thing to do but to join this live, eat a little bit of popcorn, learn a little bit of information, but not only learn, we also want you to converse with us this evening. So feel free to chat with us, whether it's through the messenger, or if you also would like to be a part of the conversation, we can also send you a link today to be a part of the conversation and join in with us live as well. But we do want this to be a open forum, not only for our guest Trinita Banks to speak, but also we may have some people out there that is very passionate about this subject or may have questions they rather ask openly versus in the chat. Says we're waiting for everyone to come in. We're going to go ahead and get started. So this week's episode, again, as we know, this is a bonus episode. If you've been following my podcast over the last few weeks, you know that on Wednesdays at 8 a.m., I always drop my episodes for the season. But I also have taken an interest of doing a bonus episode. And this is where this is a live interview where I bring people in with different subject matters. You know, we talk about grief, we talk about healing, we talk about overcoming unforeseen circumstances. And what I did when I put this podcast together is I wanted it to be an array of individuals, because when we look at grief, we look at healing, it looks different for everybody, right? It's not just about death. It's about life changes that you least expect, and understanding how to work through those things when you're feeling low, when you're feeling hopeless, when you're feeling like that there's nothing else out here for you and you just don't know where to turn. That's grief. But what is healing? Healing is getting the aspiration to say, I can make it through no matter what has been put forth to me. Now, again, I say that to say you may not always be able to do that by yourself. You may need some inspiration from a loved one. You may need some inspiration from your higher power. You may just need inspiration from a counselor, regardless of where that may come from. Healing is just like grief, right? It goes hand in hand. It goes with opportunity to be able to say that you're here and you're going to get there. And so with us today, again, we have Ms. Trinita Banks. We have Trinita Banks. Yeah. Our episode today. Good evening. So our episode today is talking about second chances at success, bridging the gap for justice involved individuals. But this is a topic, right? This is a very hot topic that has hit every state, I'm sure, in some capacity. And it's a topic that sometimes is overlooked. Sometimes it's a topic that brings about a lot of judgment. Sometimes it's a topic that is not talked about, because it causes pain, not only for the individual that is in the situation who's asked to be given a second chance, but sometimes it's pain for families, communities, for victims. But just like everything else, anything that's uncomfortable, I believe that I need to talk about, right? I believe that I need to bring it forth on this podcast, because in order for us to become educated, we must talk about uncomfortable situations. And so I am going to open it up to Trinita. Trinita, hello. How are you today?
Thank you. I'm well. I hope that you are. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So, Chalita, we have you here today because I know that this is something that's very passionate to you in so many different ways. Do you mind talking to us about why is this subject, dealing with justice-involved individuals, why is this subject so passionate to you? What got you to begin working in this arena?
Okay, great question. So I don't know if everyone knows, but one out of three people in America has a criminal background. And in 2001, when I moved to Charlotte, North Carolina, I was one of those people because I got arrested when I moved to after a year or so of being here with a small child. Arrested in 2001 and convicted in 2005. So changed my whole life. My whole trajectory on life, my whole narrative on life. I was ashamed. I hid it from my family. I hid it from my friends. I was ashamed, right? Because I was a mom. I came here from West Virginia, to make a better life for me and my child. And if anybody knows me, they know I'm a dental assistant by trade, worked in West Virginia, went to school in West Virginia, trained as a dental assistant there, and made some bad decisions once I moved here out of survival, right? And was arrested in the Mecklenburg County Detention Center, in which I now do work there, right? So this is why this subject is so personal to me. I have nine family members that are incarcerated at this moment as we speak. And just to shed light on how important that this subject is, that and to be transparent on how it affects people, families, communities, and not just that, but children, right? And we talk about public safety, then we have to talk about how we supporting our people when they transition back to the communities as well. So this is why this subject is so personal to me.
You talked a lot about how Danielle got in the system and why Danielle got in the system and how that affected her in regards to her self-esteem, what other people thought about her. And what we know is that this is very common, right? But as we talk about the personal aspect, take us into now how you have made this a life for you to help other people.
So it wasn't until I got arrested that I experienced poverty, right? If I was poor growing up, I never knew that. My dad was a coal miner. My mom, she was a housewife until my father passed. And then she had to go back into the workforce, right? But far as I know, we were taken care of. We didn't go out without anything. Raised in a community where it was a village mentality, where people took care of us. And everybody took care of each other, right? So when I was arrested and could not find a job, I was unemployed for 4 years. People don't know that, right? So maybe people from home may not know that, right? From my hometown, I moved here with the Section 8 voucher with a 5-year plan. And then once I realized that this is going to hold me back, like I can't get anything, housing. I don't care if you did have a Section 8 voucher, they check your background for housing. And then for employment, certain aspects of school, certain college degrees that you want to get into, they check your background and they may decline your application, right? But depending on what charges that you have, even for FAFSA, even for SNAP benefits, better known as food stamps, you may not be able to get those things because of certain charges, right? So, it became personal to me with workforce development because, Social Security Administration sends your record, right, of you working in from 2001 to 2000, probably six. I was empty, zero, zero, zero. I said, whoa, to look at this, right, to look back on that, right, to experience poverty in the way that it helped me be able to show somebody else how I navigated out, right? And that's exactly what our organization, Erica's Closet and Another Level Staffing, in which we work with individuals who have criminal background, helping them, advocating for them to get back into the workforce. So to ex have that experience, it was like a form of grief. Like it was certain things I couldn't do. I couldn't volunteer at my kids' school, well, my son's school at the time. I only had one child. And even with a Section 8 voucher, when it was time for me to move and my lease was up, right? and the apartment complex I lived in didn't want to accept Section 8 anymore. It was hard. I couldn't find a place to live, right? I had to go live with one of my friends who had three children, recently divorced. She's in a two-bedroom apartment, and it's all of us in one apartment, right? Mm-hmm. So for 3 months until I found a private landlord who would take the voucher for the first time. First time being a landlord, she worked in mm-hmm. corporate America. She was a Black woman, right? But she said, I heard horror stories about Section 8, let alone somebody with a criminal background, right? Right. So up on in 2010, I got a job. I was making $8.30 an hour. And I worked there for I worked there 5 years, but in the fourth year of me working there, I went back to school and I realized I never read the handbook. Yeah, we do that, right? Because we're in survival mm-hmm. mode. We just glad to have a job. Something said, read the handbook because you got to figure this out. Right. Read the handbook, realized they offered tuition reimbursement, went back to school. When I went back to school, I originally went for dental hygiene, but they wouldn't take me, right? Mm-hmm. Look, so let alone, let me rewind. I had applied for school in the past, like when I first got arrested, but they wouldn't accept me to the dental hygiene program because I had a criminal background, even with all of my recommendation letters, right? Mm-hmm. So I started school taking my prerequisites, but it was my son's behavior was so out of whack because our living situations and our lifestyle, I was out of whack. I didn't have any balance because I'm trying to survive and keep a roof over our head. So I had to stop, quit. It took about 6 years for a 2-year degree, all mm-hmm. because of one arrest, one nonviolent arrest, right? So as I graduated in 2016 from Central Piedmont Community College in a degree in human service technology, I worked at an organization who provided employment readiness for people with criminal backgrounds. I stayed there 5 years. I was there as a client. My internship fell through and my advisor at school said, hey, they have an opening. We need you to go over there. I was like, nope, that's trauma to me. I don't want to go back there. I was a client there. But they accepted me with open arms as an intern. I trained under them for a year as an intern. Commitment for 1 year. They hired me on and I transitioned from that plasma center job, $8.30 an hour to $16 and some change an hour. So I worked there 5 years. I learned everything that I possibly could. I built my network. I served, I volunteered, and my network, when I say my network, is probably worth millions of dollars right now because of the servitude. So people who have criminal records have to build their network. Networking is a key. It's key because you got to find your tribe in this in order to make it. So this is how I got into the space that I'm into now with helping others transition and showing them how to navigate through the systems and the processes.
Go back for a second, right? You talked about the shame that you had and not wanting people to know what had happened. So mm-hmm. talk to us about once they found out what happened, right? Like how long did it take for individuals to find out whether they were loved ones, whether they were friends? And once they did, tell us about what did that look like for Danielle?
So I kept it under wraps for as long as I could. Like my mom never could understand like why you can't keep a job, why you can't keep money? Because as you know, you'll get a job, get hired, they'll fire you once your background come back. And that mm-hmm. happened to me multiple times. There's been a lot of crying days. But a lot of people, my story didn't come out until the organization that I worked for outside of college, when I graduated college, had me speaking for newspapers, magazines. It wasn't until I learned how to advocate for others. I joined different groups that provided advocacy. So it wasn't mm-hmm. until I learned how to lift my voice and advocate for myself that I could advocate for others. And that's when my story came out. So by the time my story came out, I had done enough advocacy work to earn a little bit more respect that you really didn't see the negative past, right? So I say that to say this to people in the community, for individuals who are getting released from prisons and jails and family members, don't be ashamed, like, because they done went, they paid their dues, and being locked up in a cage is not always the best thing for a person, especially if they're suffering from mental illness or behavioral health issues or substance misuse or abuse, right? And then they just lock them up because most of their charges or behaviors are because of those challenges. And those challenges come from traumatic experiences that we've had as children, young adults, some that our family don't know about, right? So I'm saying this to the community and to families, like, don't be ashamed of your loved ones transitioning back to the community, because they need to know how to maneuver and operate in this new world when they come out. Because I don't care if they've been locked up 6 months to 30 years, things change in that time frame in the climate that we live in, and we have to be able to have resources and tools for them, these individuals, to come home, to be able to maneuver around our community. Because guess what? The late James Baldwin said, if I'm starving, then you're in trouble. So if we don't have, you talk about public safety and safe communities, if we don't have tools and resources in place for our people to transition back from incarceration, from being in cages and doing, you know, coming back to the community, if we don't have support for them when they come out, what normally happens is we go back to our criminal behavior, because that's the only way we know how to survive. And it worked in our mindset at one time. So we have to have that support and that therapeutic setting for them. So I'm encouraging families, if you have someone that's about to come home, start preparing now. Start preparing for the things that they're going to need. Connect yourself with organizations that do this work, reentry work, so that your family member will have the support and tools, because you may not know, you know, all you know is they done something, they went to jail, you're ashamed, the community talk about it, they're not the first one. But we have to be prepared.
Yeah, I think that you said something very important, is even if we don't know what our loved ones may need, right? Because all we think they need is a hug. Like, we haven't seen them in years. We haven't seen them in months. You know, there is no contact visit. We're talking to them behind a wall or talking to them behind a window or whatever on a phone. They need more than a hug, right?
Exactly.
It's reintegrating them back into a society that's even strange for us on a day-to-day basis. So imagine being in an environment that's structured. Someone's telling you when to go to bed. Someone's telling you when to eat. Someone's telling you when to do all these different things. And then you come out here in the world that's cruel, right? So what I hear you saying is, for a family that doesn't know, is to begin to connect themselves with reentry programs within their own communities. How hard is that for a loved one to do?
If they don't know of any, they can call us, because I know some communities are in rural areas and they don't have anyone that, or they may not know of any orgs that are doing the work. You could call us. We operate in West Virginia if needed. We are registered. Our organization is registered in West Virginia, and we are also registered in Charlotte, North Carolina. But we get calls from all over just because of some of the work that we've done. So I encourage them to even contact the case managers inside the detention centers that their family members are there. And I know that's like a needle in a haystack, because sometimes they're not really doing, they're working at capacity and they're not really doing what we think that they should do for our people. So sometimes you can send them an email, a call, or something to let them know that this person has a family member outside that's concerned about their transition. So to start educating yourself on who's doing the work in your community, reentry councils. I know that West Virginia has a reentry council. They have ACLU there that you could connect with. We have Reverend, I know Mr. Reverend Watts does some reentry work. We have different individuals who are formerly incarcerated who does some work there. And here in Charlotte, we have reentry councils. We have groups, different, many organizations that's doing this work. But if individuals need, have questions, they can call us.
In the work that you do on a day-to-day basis, you and your staff, how do you convince employers to give individuals with a criminal background a second chance? And what success have you seen in changing their perceptions?
So how we get employers to engage with us, partner with us to hire our individuals is, as you know, now with the death of George Floyd, a lot of people have social impact initiatives going on within their companies and their businesses, right? Of social injustice type things going on, right? So we're holding them accountable for that stuff. If you say, if it's on your website that you say you do this, safer communities, you stand, you know, with the decision made for George Floyd's death and all this stuff, because in the height of that, this is where this all developed.
Okay.
So we meet with employees, we build partnerships with them, letting them know there's tax credits, there's the federal bonding. The government will bond a person for up to 6 months, right? So that if they come into your company and God so forbid that they do something, they don't have any, there's an insurance in place. Here in Charlotte, the Workforce Development Board has OJT, right? You, if you hire them, then there's a kickback with your salary. We're reimbursing you so much of the person's salary. So we use different initiatives like that. And then overall, guess what? You're creating a safer community, not just for you, but for your children. And our organization not only supports the job seeker, we support the employer as well. So we're boots on the ground. So we go to the job, the place of employment, and we make sure that the job, the employer doesn't need support, because we need to make sure that they're using the correct language and they're engaging in a supportive way to the individuals that, that they consider hiring from our pool of job seekers. And then we make sure before we send our job seeker that we've tackled all of those barriers, food, shelter, clothing, all of those basic needs, right? Those wellness, the dimensions of wellness, right? Because we know if a person don't know where they sleeping at nighttime, or they ain't had nothing to eat, they ain't got no clothes, they can't wash their body, they can't focus at work.
Right.
So we have to tackle those barriers first, making sure they have their identifying documents, right? ID, social security card, birth certificate, making sure they have transportation in place. So we support both parties. So that's the uniqueness of our organization, to ensure the employer, hey, if this person, you recognize that they're they have a pattern, they've been showing up late, let us know so we could, because 9 times out of 10, they're trying to figure something out and they don't know, should I call in to work or should I go get this bill paid or something, or take the baby to school, or get my car fixed, right? So we try to help dissolve some of those, decrease some of those barriers, right? And before we connect them with the employer. So we support both parties. That's the uniqueness of getting the employer's buy-in, because guess what? Their goal is to keep the business going and have a ROI, return on investment. And that is the goal for us to see. For instance, we have an individual, two individuals right now, three, as of yesterday, we had a new working at the Charlotte Douglas Airport. And combined, they probably did combine all their years in prison. It's probably about 50 years in prison. And it's, they are all working. One has been there 2 years. One has been at this company 2 months. And then the other one's been there this their first week on the job. And it has been like a like just like a great a feeling of gratitude to see these men with all these 22 years in prison, 23, been locked up since he was 14, he 45, and to be able to work and provide for their family, right? To see them engaging with their grandkids, taking their grandkids out on outings, right? Because they don't have to do what they used to do to create a sense of revenue, because they didn't have a parent in the house, or they had to take care of themselves because of some trauma. So, so that is the biggest picture of this, the biggest outcome that we bask in, to see someone be able to stand up on their own feet as just an individual that is formerly incarcerated.
Right. So you said something, I'm not sure if our listeners caught it, but I did, right? You talked about language, right? You talked about being able to go into these employers and make sure they're using the appropriate language. Let's talk about that, because there may be some listeners right now that don't know what the appropriate language is. They may not know what one is expecting.
Yeah, so it's up to us. Right. It's up to us to make people respect us, because just because we were incarcerated or we have something on our criminal background, I'm not a felon. I'm a person who had a criminal background. So let me take that back, because my record is expunged. So I'm free. But some others, we advocate person first. You put the person first. This is a person who is formerly incarcerated. This is a job seeker who has a criminal background. You put the person first, because when you put the title in front of that person, that's you're naming them. So we make sure that the employer and everyone involved in the support system understand we don't use criminal. We don't use felons. We don't use druggies, we don't use addicts, we don't use all the other language that, you know, slang that we use in the community. We put the person first.
If you've looked at the title today, Justice Involved Individuals, is that the appropriate word as well, Danielle, to use?
Yes, people who have a criminal background, people who are justice impacted individuals. That is the new language. People with criminal backgrounds. Yeah. People with substance abuse or substance misuse. Because, see, we have to understand that too. People with behavioral health issues, right? Substance misuse and substance abuse is two different things, right? Some people misuse it because something has happened and they were on a certain type of substance and became addicted to that substance because it was misused. And then you have abuse, right? Some people use it in a way where they had some type of traumatic experience and they turned to that because they just had no other support. And I know some people don't agree with that and they may come on here with that, right? But it happens. People experience trauma and grief and things like that in different ways. And what may be grief and trauma to us may not be to other people. There's a difference.
Everybody has a story and everybody ain't always open up about their story. And sometimes they're just what their story is, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I'm very sometimes transparent. Our business. But it takes for a healed person to be able to be transparent about what happened. So no one can say anything to me about what happened and within my background and make me feel bad about it, because I have healed from that part, right? Mm-hmm. I have made it through all the trials and tribulation that comes with being arrested. And that's why I have the lived experience and the expertise to be able to help somebody else.
So you bring up an important conversation piece. So Danielle has that, right? But how do we convince someone who may not have the same strength that you have to say, I have this experience, I'm healed from this? What kind of, if there was someone that's watching right now that falls in the category of being justice involved, what is some aspirations or inspirations that you can give that individual to get to that place, to be able to look at themselves, to say the same thing that Danielle's been able to say today to our listeners?
Yeah. How's it working for you? If what you're doing is what you're doing right now, lining up with what you want for yourself, for your future, for your kids, 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 how's that working for you? Is it working? Mm-hmm. If it's not, what can you do differently? What do you need support with? I'm quick to ask a person, what do you want? Because when you've been incarcerated or you've come in contact with law enforcement or from just being in a Black family, you've been told what to do. Because from Black families, children were seen and not heard. So we have sometimes, it comes from a lineage, a heritage from us, Black and brown people, and slavery, literally, of not being able to voice our opinion. So just because you have some type of criminal background or being justice impacted in some way, what do you want? Is that working? If what you're doing working for you, do you want to do? If offered an opportunity, would you do something different? I'm quick to give them that option because, see, you put it back in their lap. They're able to tell you what they want. This is not working for me. I struggle with this section of my life. What's an opportunity that I could take to help me change this part of my life, right? Because sometimes what we don't understand as a community, right? Something happened. Something happened along that person's journey that sent them in that either survival mode, safety mode, and then they ended up in criminal activity. So their environment, their access to resources such as education, healthcare, all of that, to food, shelter, clothing, all of that plays into criminal behavior. It's called criminogenic factors, and people have to understand that. I don't just wake up and say, I'm going to go shoot some guns, or I don't just wake up and say, I'm going to go rob the store.
Right.
So I always ask that person, how is it working for you? And if given an opportunity, would you do something different?
I ask you that question because I know in Erica's closet, there's job coaching. And in job coaching, there's some real questions that have to be asked sometimes that are not so pretty, but they're real, right? Because in order to be able to change, we must talk about things that make you feel uncomfortable. We must talk to you about things that maybe people in your life didn't know to ask you. Right.
Yep.
Because it could be a generational type behavior. And so finally, there's this person who comes in your life to say, I understand what you're going through. I've been there. This is where I am. But now I must ask you, what exactly is it that you want? Yep. Right. You're not giving them the answer, Danielle. What you're saying is, what do you want? Because when they begin, whoever they may be, begin to put some ownership in what they want, then it allows them to have some, a lead way to walk on a path that even may turn a little bit narrow, right?
Yep.
There may be some doors that's thrown in their face, shut in their face. There may be some rocks in the road they had to step over.
Yeah.
But now they're on a path to say, this is what I want to do, even though it still may not be easy.
Exactly. Exactly. And we see that a lot in our job coaching because our career coaching, because sometimes depending on what your charges are, you might have to take a paycheck. We call a paycheck job, a band-aid job, take you from zero to maybe 10, right? Mm-hmm. And ideal, that's not enough to survive, but you not on zero. It's enough to get you on your feet, to get you back in the swing of things of working, to getting a paycheck, to being mindful of how you're spending your money, to making sure that you're taking care of your paying your cell phone bill, you're paying your living expenses, right? What you can't afford, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then it prepares you for the career path, right? When you get into the career path that's paying you more money, that's giving you the benefits, healthcare, vision, dental, right? Then you know if you can handle the little bit, be a good steward over the little bit, get in routine and have some balance over the little bit, then you'll be ready for the next level. Because like Biggie Small said, more money, more problems. Because as you make more money, things are going to increase. See? Mm-hmm. And so when I back to what I said, I was making $8.35. Then I went to $16 and some cents. And then I went to $18. I'm transparent. $18 and some cents. And then I went to $21 and some sense, and then I won't disclose what I make now, right, as an entrepreneur. But it's been some dark, dark nights. So we have to coach that individual on, you may not start off at $25 an hour because you used to be a surveyor, used to survey land, or you used to be a HVAC tech. But now we have to start you and gradually move you up to your career path. And in between there, you may have to get some upskilling. You may have to get some training. You may have to go back to school. So we want to make sure that you have something to meet your basic needs financially while we offer the wraparound support from our other community partners, right, to help support you. So I always give this. You make an example. You're in the boxing ring, and we're just here. We're on the outside keeping you from falling out. Now, when you hitting the ropes, we here, we coaching you, we agging you on, right? But if you get out the ring, that was your decision to get out the ring. You stopped the fight.
Mm-hmm.
Ain't nothing we could do about that because that's your decision.
Right.
But you first have to be transparent about what do you want and what are your challenges. Deep down inside, if you know I'm mishandling. I have a substance issue that I need treatment for, and I need to start there. Right. Or I have some trauma that happened to me as a child. I need to go to a therapeutic setting. Right. Because I can't focus. This is why I behave the way that I do. Right. So until we're able, as Black, just as a community, but specifically Black and Brown people, to not sweep things under the rug. Right. That may be traumatic that causes these types of behaviors for individuals who become involved in the criminal system. We got to be transparent. We got to come together about it. And I understand that there may even be some victims out there, the people that are on the other side, right? Where the person who is incarcerated done the crime and they're part of a victim, right? You don't want them people, the people who committed the crime against your family member or your friend or your community member getting out with no resources or support. They've been locked in a cage. So you want them to have all the support that they need or get what they need while they're back there, or it's just this is where the cycle come in at because of the support. So this is why we advocate for restorative practices and funding, unrestricted funding, funding that will allow us to be fluent and transparent with helping our people. When you box us in or with the funding, sometimes it's hard to serve the people's needs because that funding, people see us getting grants and awards and stuff. And I mentioned this because it goes hand in hand, but that sometimes is allotted for a certain specific population and you have to have certain requirements. And I mean, it's hard as a leader in the community of a nonprofit. So yeah, we have to be transparent as a group of people about incarceration and to be able to offer these individuals the support and coach them back to a place where they can be self-sufficient.
Now, I think you brought up something, and I'm going to be very transparent as well. So, I have a background in criminal justice. So, my BA is in criminal justice correction with a minor in legal studies and sociology. My master's is in correctional counseling. And so, I have two different views. I had one view, right, as a criminal justice major with a BA, had a whole different view with a master's degree. Because what we know is not only is the individual going into the criminal justice system with trauma, there's also trauma induced while they're in the system,
Exactly.
right? There's also things that are not talked about on a regular basis that individuals are going through. So now we have a layer of trauma that they're now brought
Exactly.
back into a society that's also trauma, right? But
Exactly.
let's just talk about the individuals who are placed in solitary confinement. Let's go there, right? I'm gonna go there.
Yeah, go
What
there
I know
because we
about,
know real.
yeah, it's real, right? As I understand the why it's in place, I also understand that we as people need human interaction, right? Because let's go here for a second. I don't always think clear on a day-to-day basis. Sometimes I need somebody to say, Keisha, now what you saying and what you doing don't quite make sense. I may not like what they're saying, but I may sit back and be like, you know what? You're right. So I've had somebody to be able to shift my mindset because that's hierarchy of need, right?
Exactly.
But when you're placed in a box and all you have is four walls, nobody else is communicating with you, no one else is telling you, John Doe, Jane Doe, what you're thinking, what you're saying just is not right. So when all you have is your own mind playing against you, there's trauma, right? We're not talking about all the other things that they are enduring. We're just talking about individuals that are placed in solitary confinement for 23 hours out of a day. And then we're expecting them to come back in general population and be okay. And then we're reintegrating them back out into society, expecting this individual to be okay. That's why
To be
services like
okay.
yours are important because now
Yeah.
we have all the trauma outside of what they went to jail with
Exactly.
that we don't talk about.
So imagine during COVID. When They were doing 20, they call it 23 and one, where you're inside your cell for 23 hours and you only come out 1 hour. Imagine, and it's little, I don't know if people know that. It's little, literally like a closet and not no walk-in closet, if that, right? And imagine being in there 23 hours of your day. No human touch. And I'm using COVID because I'm not talking as when they, I'm going to use it, talk about it when they use it as punishment too, right? So during COVID, we got trillions and billions and thousands and hundreds of calls about how they were being treated. Excuse me. At the beginning, it was kind of serious, right? And then I think some of the staff misused their power, abused their power during COVID. And sometimes they didn't get let out. Right. And we know for hierarchy of needs, human touch and connection is needed. And, you know, there was a study done with a group of babies in the early 60s, 70s. Right. And I can't never remember the name of it. I need to go back to my books and look it up, where they held some babies more than they held the others. And the ones that they didn't touch the most kind of got depressed, and these little lap babies, right? So imagine a grown person, and then you release them. I've had friends to tell me they was in confinement for 6 months, hours and hours a day, and no touch, no, not coming out. Sometimes they went in there for protection because other residents of that detention center, or inmates, as whatever you would call, we would say residents of that center or that facility, was threatening them or trying to get them to become a part of a collective group or a gang, right? And they didn't want to, so they were going to solitary confinement for safety, or they were put in there for punishment, or just by someone in a staff member abusing their power. Imagine, I can't imagine, you know, going a day without talking to my family or my friend, you know, having that human connection. That's a need.
Yes.
People always say, I can make it alone in this world. You can't. You still need human connection. So imagine somebody being in solitary confinement for months at a time. And then, you know, for periods, months, and then they may get out and go back in for months, depending on the circumstances. And then they get released back to the community. You tell me, logically, right? I heard you say you had master's, bachelor's, right? Logically, mentally, that they're supposed to come home and the family, or excuse me, family, get a job. You just need to get a job. They got the family members fussing them. They got the probation officers. They got a monitor on their leg. It's beeping when they go dead. And it don't work. It's not logical. It's not healthy. Let's put it like that.
So as we talk about the unforeseen and the seen, things that go on, things that we control, things that we cannot, and we talk about the services that Erica's Closet provides. I know that you provide clothing, you provide job coaching for individuals that are coming back out into society. They're reintegrating is the word I wish to use. But why do you believe these services are critical for successful reintegration back into society?
These services are so critical, again, because if a person comes and they don't even have clean clothes, and I guess because I've seen it firsthand, people getting out in their whites, that's what they call it, and I'm gonna go ahead and just be transparent, whitey tighty underwear, white socks, the flip-flops. Like last year, me and my daughter, actually, there was a young lady getting released from the detention center. She got arrested in June. They was letting her out Christmas Eve. I mind you, the staff was gone. That's the county. They were at home with their family. We were sitting in the release station waiting on her to come out because she had on one shoe. They couldn't find her other shoe on her property. She had on shorts. It's probably 20 degrees outside. She had on shorts, short sleeve shirt. She had on some long johns, but she gave the long johns to the guy behind her because he didn't have nothing. So imagine you got arrested in June, you getting out in December, and you don't have nothing. That messes with your mental health. These services are so for individuals or organizations like ours to be supported by larger entities so that we could perform these duties and these supportive services so that they want safe communities. This is what safe communities look like. This is a public, it's almost a public health issue. It is a public health issue. Let's just forget about safety, because if we healthy, then we're safe. We're going to keep our health safe. And our mental is a part of our health.
Right.
So if and anybody knows, we protect our mental at some point because it's a part of our health. If your mind ain't right, ain't nothing going to be right. So these services are just that critical right there. Just simple as clothing. I didn't even go into workforce development because you got to start at the basic needs. Because if I'm hungry, I can't focus on nothing. Let me just eat. I can't even talk to you right now, right? If I'm thirsty, I got an individual right now. He's still wearing his glasses from prison with tape on them from 2 years. He been released 2 years. Why ain't nobody got this man no glasses? And he working. Unfortunately, he doesn't have health care benefits on his job. He got a job, but it doesn't offer health care benefits because he's still temporary. But he's been released for 2 years. You get it? So this is why it's so critical. It's critical not just for like but the children that are involved, these individuals' children, to make us better parents, so that we could provide for our children, because we're going to end up paying taxes and putting money back into the community if we're able to provide for our family. Increase upward mobility.
Right. So you brought up something, Danielle, when you talk about children. I want to go back a tad bit. You were a mother of one child at that time when you got in trouble. What we know is that this is very common in our society. So let's talk a little bit about mothers, single mothers, who are involved in the criminal justice system. And what does that look like on so many different levels? From your experience, not just personally, but just even in your work experience.
So as a mom, you know, we have different instincts. It's either your motherly instinct kicks in when you have children or it just doesn't, right?
Mm-hmm.
We have different instincts than the dads, right? You know, it just is what it is. It's genetic, right? Excuse me. At some point, instinct is going to kick in to where you want to take care of your children. So you're going to do all that. And it's crazy because we talked about this in our church service today, how women are able to balance a little bit more than men. Like, we'll do 50-11 things and be successful at it, like cooking and cleaning with the baby on a hip and everything, because it's just in us. It's just genetic, right? So as a woman involved in the criminal system, we have to be supported and be able to navigate the systems and know how to use our supports, right? So I mentioned I had Section 8 voucher. I had, at the time, I was receiving SNAP, which is better known as food stamps. The only resource I probably didn't get was the child care. When I did get child care, my daughter got it for after school, and it was only because another county had extra money and it funneled down into our county. I got it for 90 days. So I had an older lady who raised my daughter for the most part, right? So the support, making sure that they go and get the support that they need, utilize the resources to help you get on your feet. Cause right now, if you receive SNAP benefits, they'll pay for training for you. So figure out what you can use your transferable skills and that your background, your charges won't affect getting a job in that career path. You have to do some research. It's going to take a little extra step. And go to your workforce development board or your DSS. Hey, I received SNAP. I know that y'all will pay for my training, right? Because they want you off the benefits.
Mm-hmm.
They want you off the benefits so that you can sustain. Go get that training. Go get that upskilling. Keep your child while you're still eligible for child care and you're still eligible for Medicaid. Utilize that system. Don't get stuck in it. Utilize it to help you get to the next level while you're training. So the whole time you're training, you're eligible for that because you're not making a lot of money because your background is kind of holding you back. But once you get that training and you've researched enough to know that your background won't be much as effect on that career path, you're going to be okay. But you got to have a plan in place. right? And utilize your supports and not be ashamed to utilize those supports. Because this is another thing when we talk about the children and the mothers, right? I know that some schools there have like volunteers who go in and kind of mentor the kids at the certain schools, right? So you have to remember, once you start seeing behavioral issues in a child, anyone who works in a school system or in the community, stop that child. See what's going on. Where your mama at? Where your daddy at? Go find them. See what support that parent need to help that child be a little more secure. Behaviors will decrease. I promise you, my family is a prime example of that. Just that right there. Finding that support. But it takes that one person from the community to identify this child acting up. This child bad. Stop saying they bad. Go find out what's happening at home, because we don't know if they done woke up. Mama done went to work, had to get to work before the school bus came. They had to get their younger siblings together, get everybody on the bus. That's a lot of responsibility.
Right.
So go see what support the family need. We got to get back to the village mentality and stop being so judgmental. It's hard now, because sometimes people will abuse that, right? Because we're just human. And we operate out of scarcity sometimes. But if for single women that has been affected by the criminal system, we have to utilize our supports, identify our supports, connect with people who are doing positive things. That's for anybody. And and build you a tribe. Build you a tribe so that you can figure out what your path is.
And thank you for that. I'm looking at some of the comments in the chat right now, and I know that we have some professionals out here that are doing this work on a day-to-day basis, whether they're working in the juvenile justice system, whether they're working in the school systems, whether they have been involved in the criminal justice system. And so I thank them for some of the comments that they're making. I know that when you were talking about being in the ring and, you know, are you going to stay and fight?
Right.
Are you going to get
right.
out? Right. I know that Yvonne is on here and she says, amen, you have to crawl before you walk. And she says, been there and done that. Right. I want to thank Yvonne, because one thing I know about Yvonne, for anybody that know her, is listen to the story, listen to the episode right now. She is one that is very, very transparent about who she is, who she was, and what she's doing currently in our community to make sure to be a voice for those that may not feel like they have a voice, that don't even know what word to use when they're in a moment of feeling hopelessness. And so for all of those out here that are doing this work, I definitely want to thank you all on a day-to-day basis, because everybody, I say this again, everybody needs somebody.
Yes.
Right? Everybody needs somebody. It don't matter what your situation is, don't matter what your circumstances are, everybody needs somebody. And one of the things that I often used to say, Danielle, and I still say this, is we're all, hear me when I say this, everybody, we're all one mistake away from being like somebody whom you may have judged, may still be judging,
yep,
or that may be in your family, right?
Exactly.
We're all one mistake away. So
exactly.
I'm always about, be careful about what you say about other folk, because somebody can then begin talking about you to be exactly like that person whom you talked about. One of the things I want to ask you is, as you've been in this line of work and you've talked about, you know, I just heard you talk about the people that you've gotten employed at the airport, but can you share with us a specific story of a transformation, a time when someone that you helped exceeded expectations and achieve personal success?
So recently, so we were awarded, we have a project that we partner with our local detention center, and we provide, so they take a training, the NCCER OSHA 10 training, which is construction training behind the walls, and then up on, we work with them pre and post, right? Providing them services, helping them build a developmental plan, helping them build a career pathway. And up when they're released, the main goal is wraparound services, case management, and rapid employment. We had an individual who has been in and out of incarceration since childhood. I think he's probably 38, 39. He stood and told us, he said, hey, I deny my bond to stay here to get these services, because you all are the only ones who came in here, done what you said you were going to do. And he said, I've been in and out of prison all my life. And I got four kids out there that need me, that depend on me. He said, and I told my family, do not pay my bond. I want to do it different this time. He got released. He's been working for about 6 months now. He's been on the job. It's been bumpy. He's reconnected with his children. He recently just caught a plane to Iowa to visit with his older children. He's rekindled his relationship with the children. He's having good experiences on his job. He's saving his money. He's living in transitional housing, looking to transition into his own place. He's using the resources that was provided to him. He said, this is the first time I've ever used the resources that was provided to me. He said, and I am so happy. I mean, he was mean as a rattlesnake when we met him, but now he laughed, he smiled, he spent a time. He was so excited to go visit his kids for Christmas and to be able to do it on his own with his own money from working and providing for himself, right? So that helps break the cycle from our children, you know, because our children are neglected. Once we get caught in that system of incarceration and having something on our criminal background, it affects everybody down to the smallest child. So to see him just succeed and he's happy, that's the key. When you're happy, you do happy stuff. So that is the most recent success story. If you go to our YouTube channel and on our website and our social medias, you'll see a story of Ty done 22 years in the prison, lost his both his parents. When he got out, he had nobody but his one child, his two grandchildren that he reunited with. Ty's been on his job for 2 years. Ty's doing one. He did 22 years in prison, and he is doing wonderful. When he bought his car, he came to my office. He was like, look, Trilata, get in it, sit in it, right? So it's moments like that, like where they're able to just provide for themselves, to buy their kids something, to take their kids to a movie, to buy their mom a gift, to provide for someone in the family, to give somebody $5, you know? So, yeah, if you go to our YouTube channel, we just recently started a YouTube channel and our website, and that's Erica's-closet.org. We have Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, YouTube, and we have our website. You can see some of those. Well, you can see Ty's story.
So let me talk about that mean rattlesnake that you just talked about. That's in Iowa, right? When you start talking about that mean rattlesnake, what I heard is someone who didn't have trust.
No.
Someone who probably was a mean rattlesnake because that was their defense mechanism, because somebody at some point of their life, whether it was childhood, whether it was adulthood, whether it was in the criminal justice system, have lied, have let him down, may have not believed in that rattlesnake because of his background, right? Yep. And then he finally found not just one person, but a whole organization that said, we believe in you.
Yeah,
we're going to be here for you. We're going to show up, right? That's my key word. It's about showing up. Sometimes that's all it takes for people, is just to show up to say, I hear you. I'm here for you.
Yes.
I will continue to be here through the struggle. I'll continue to be here through the trenches. And so that mean rattlesnake was able to shed some of that skin.
You know
how snakes shed?
Oh, yeah.
Because he finally realized that somebody cared about him. So there was no need to be angry. There was no need to put up this wall because somebody said, I got you.
Yep.
Right. Somebody said the grass is greener on the other side, and we're not that snake that's been fighting you.
Exactly.
That's what it sounds like to me.
Exactly. And that's just him. That's just his story. He also mentioned, he says, I learned to control my anger and my emotions, and not lead with my emotions. So that's some of the training. So there's a training here in North Carolina called Working Smart. It's being revised right now, but it talks about how you lead with your emotions. You make decisions based on your emotions. And sometimes when we make decisions based on your emotions, it's not logical. It's not a logical decision to a certain challenge that you're having. So you have to stop a minute, check yourself before you wreck yourself, and then decide what's going to give me the least most negative consequences if I make this decision, and what's going to give me the closest outcome to the goal that I want. So that's something that me and my staff, we facilitate that training, but they also take it behind the walls here at our local detention center, but we offer it as well. So he was able to, reframe and refer back to some of the skills that he has been given and tools that he has been given to survive.
What do you think is a misconception that society has about justice involved individuals? And how do we combat this stereotype through the work that you do? And how do we combat this within our own communities? Right? Because every community may not have an Erica's Closet, but every community may have a voice like Erica's Closet. Every community may have a voice like the visionary being yourself in their community. So when we talk about the misconceptions, what are some misconceptions that you think that we have here in our societies, and what can we do to combat that?
Oh, they just gonna do it again. Don't help them, because they ain't gonna do nothing but take your money or rob you or steal from you and do it again. They just gonna go get high with your money or they just gonna do it again and be right back in prison. Think about it. When you see someone get released, if it's your family member or someone in the community, they release them right back to the community where the crime happened at, or where the trauma happened at, right? With no resources, they right back to square one. And it's so easy, right? Because you don't have the tools and the resources. So the small town that I come from, they release people right back, put them on probation and deem them there, regardless if they say, hey, I want to go over here and stay because it's safer. And you still release them back, right, to that same community with no resources, no mobility, no tools, no support. And we go right back doing what we know how to do to survive. We have to stop thinking that that's it. We have to look at it as, what are we doing as a community? When you see someone get out and you know that they don't have it, what are you doing? Hey, come over here. I'm gonna try to get you a job at my job. Come over and let me feed you. Come over. I got some clothes for you. You ain't got to go take nothing from nobody. I know you. What do you need? How can I help you? How can I support you? Now, then if that person makes the decision to go back and do that, then that's what they wanted to do. After all the support that you've given them, people still make choices, and we can't help that. There's always going to be that one person who just said, we have individuals that'll say, hey, I was safer locked up. The misconceptions
comes their norm.
The misconceptions are, we have to start asking, presenting people with opportunities, providing people with opportunities to do something different and not to be so judgmental, because some of us, it's a lot of us out here that would have a criminal background, except we ain't get caught.
Say that one more time.
It's a lot of us out here that done stuff, that's doing stuff right now in our professional world, and we just ain't got caught, or we didn't get caught. So we have to stop the judgment and figure out, what are you doing as a community? You know, go back to the village mentality. If you present someone with a, you don't know what a person would do with an opportunity until you present it to them.
Right.
That's just the misconceptions of everything. Because guess what? Individuals with criminal backgrounds are going to be the ones who go to, if you give them an opportunity to get a decent job, they going to work. I can tell you that from just anecdote stories. We've served 490 people this year. So on a staff of three.
Wow. That's impactful.
So,
and that's just in the Charlotte area, correct? Or the county, Mecklenburg County.
They've come from all over, but mostly, yes, in Charlotte, Mecklenburg. If I talk to you, or if we've touched somebody on my staff, have touched you and provided you with a service, you in our system.
All right. So in addition to an employment, right, what other forms of support do you think are necessary to help individuals transition back into the community successfully?
Housing, healthcare, behavioral health services, access to those things. because it's so much rigmarole and processes to get access to these types of things that it presents another barrier up on getting out. So housing, first thing, they have to have a safe place to sleep, even with probation. How you gonna put a monitor on someone who's homeless and then tell them to meet you on the corner at 6 o'clock on Wednesday so that I can amount, where you are, right? Our shelters are full, right? So housing, mental health access, therapeutic settings, having free access to these services, free access to health care, dental care, vision care. Because as you know, the lighting inside a prison is horrible, which causes people to have strokes, which causes them to have vision issues when they get out. Don't get the proper health care on the inside. So having access to those things up on their return, will change the whole, just access will change the whole narrative.
As you are a grassroots organization, right? What I hear is that there's a layer, there's multiple layers of services. There's multiple layers of needs that not just one organization can handle. This comes from the federal, from the state, from the you know, local communities. This is a holistic approach, yes. Right? That's what I hear you saying. What I hear you saying is that it's not just three people in the office that's touching 400 individuals. This is a holistic, from the juvenile justice system, from the home, from the school, from the juvenile justice system, from the federal level, from the state level. So this is a larger issue.
It's multifaceted, right? And it takes 10 organizations to help one person, because you're not just supporting that one person. They might say, I can't go to work because I don't have childcare. Now you're focusing on the children, because right now McKinley Vento is an issue, right? Mm-hmm. With one of our partner organizations. That's what they're focusing on right now. Individuals with children who are formerly incarcerated, who are have children in the school system who are unhoused, right? And then we have another partner who focuses on food, right, and housing insecurities. Then we have another partner who focuses on single mothers with children. We have another partner who focuses on getting identified doctors. We have another partner who focuses on the mental health benefits. So then we have another partner who may focus on transitional living. Then we have the other organization. So it goes micro, macro. It's kind of like how Harriet Tubman led people out of slavery. We lead people out of incarceration, and we have to go underground, because see, the larger organizations, there's politics connected to it, and there's processes and requirements, when sometimes our people don't qualify. So we have to go behind the curtain, send an email to somebody, look, you owe me a favor, or let's work together. We're serving the same person, coordinate the services. Because when you coordinate the services, you wrap that person. This is why they call it coordinated services and wrapping that person up in services. This is why they call it wraparound services. So we all have to work together. Organizations and leaders in the community have to work together just to assist one person. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we all bump heads, right? As leaders in the community, because we frustrated, we try to make it. But guess what? When it comes to the people, we get that work done. So we are the Harriet Tubmans, the Underground Railroad to Reentry.
Well, we appreciate you. So as we've talked about what society can do to help individuals that are reintegrating back out into society, I want you to talk about this just in case we do have some listeners right now that are in the criminal justice system, have a criminal background, feel defeated, feel that there's no hope out here for them. There's no Erica's Closet in my community. I need help, right? What advice would you give someone with a criminal background who is struggling to believe in the possibility of a second chance?
I always say, find you some organization that's doing something and tell them, this is where I need help at. I just came home. I don't have this. I need this. I need that. And how can you help me? If you can't help me, where can you send me to? So in West Virginia, I would encourage everyone to go to the American Job Center and the Workforce Development Board. Start there. Then they have the Reentry Council. Those are the ones that I know off the top of my head that would probably get them going a little bit. If not, just call us. I don't know what we could do from, like, we have partners and people who do advocacy work in different states from where we go to our trainings out of state for advocacy and organizing that we may be able to connect you with. Call us if you hit a brick wall. We can't make you any promises, but we will try to get you connected and help you get on a career path. So our office number is 704-919-0894. 704-919-0894. I know it's hard in rural areas. They don't have access to hardly anything, even not even internet. So I know it's harder in rural areas for people to get access and support that they need.
So this is the call to action. Okay. I always believe in a call of action because we all have a duty. Mm-hmm. We all have a civil duty. We all have a personal duty to just be human, right? Yep. And just to show up for people because we all have needed somebody to show up for us. Yep. So my question is, what message would you like to send to business owners, community leaders, policymakers about the importance of supporting justice-involved individuals?
Opportunity. If you are a decision maker, whether you're in the policy, whether you're a business owner, whether you're a faith-based organization, lift your voice, create a space, create opportunity, whatever it is you can do, whether you donate, whether you volunteer, whether you are a decision maker on your job and you're able to make a decision. If you work in human resources, bring up diversity. This is diversity. Because when you don't accept individuals for business owners, right, and employers, it's borderline discrimination, right, without being in a policy, right? No blanket policies. Put a policy in place. We'll accept this. We'll accept this. Maybe, you know, let's talk about this. What organizations are you working with before we hire you? Are you getting support from someone? Let's talk to these organizations. How can we come together and help this person? Right. Mm-hmm. For policymakers, the Clean Slate Initiative, automating expungements, right? For an individual like me, it took 20 years to get my record expunged. Being lenient on when someone gets arrested, when you dismissing charges, go ahead and automatically expunge that from that person's record so that won't show up when they go apply for a job, right? For policymakers, for housing. If people are coming into your communities or to your cities, developers, and they're building these apartment complexes and they're building homes and they're adjusting to the codes in the city to build certain homes, make sure that they're coming in with an attitude of individuals with barriers such as criminal records. How are we going to house them? How are we going to engage with them to make sure that they get housed too? Mm-hmm. Right? So for our faith-based organizations, don't beat us with the Bible. Be open with us coming in. You feed us long enough, we'll stay. If you have some social justice initiatives in your church, be open to letting people come in, and men in the church who've been formerly incarcerated, or just mentor somebody. You know, if you see a child that's heading down the wrong way, pull them to the side. What's happening? What you need? Because 9 times out of 10, it's a need that's not being met. Or there's a parent at home that's struggling. Say something, do something. And don't just drop it. See it through. Be consistent, right? And it's hard because everybody got their own struggles going on. But if you want to live in a safer community, that's what it looks like.
Tell them one more time.
If you want to live in a safer, healthier community, that's what it looks like. If you tired of people standing in front of your house hustling, or if you tired of people standing on the corner hustling, 9 times out of 10, there's a need not being met. Mm-hmm. No, you can't approach everybody. Right. But there's a way to approach people. Instead of calling the police, go out there and see what's happening. Question: what do you need? What are you lacking? What's where your mama at? Especially if they under 18, where your mama at? Where your daddy at? Let's talk about this before you get yourself in a world of trouble that we can't get you out of.
You know, I think you said something that I think sometimes we fail to realize. And I'm gonna go back to the youth for a second, right? Because I'm very passionate about that age group. Not every kid that's out here on the streets want to be on the streets. They're looking for someone to rescue them so it don't look like that they have been a punk to run away. I'm going to use that word for what it means, right?
Use it for what it means.
Sometimes they need somebody to be their scapegoat to get them out because they don't have the voice or the courage to say, I don't want to be here. I don't want to be a part of this gang. I don't want to be a part of this this situation, right? We have to be able to look at our kids and go back to the village and say, and I get there's some parents out here that don't want you to say nothing to the kids. We got to change that too. Let's go there, right?
Yes.
I get that sometimes these kids may come off a little bit aggressive, but let's ask ourselves why. Somebody have caused them not to trust people.
Exactly. Or have caused them some harm in some kind of way, and they don't know how to internalize that, right? Because they're too young. No one has ever addressed it. We have a young man, I've been working with him since he turned 18 while I was working inside when I was a contractor at the detention center before I started full-time as an entrepreneur. He turned 18, so they sent him from the juvenile center to the adult center. And he's now doing 10 years in a state prison. He calls me weekly. He said, Miss Banks, he said, I was 16. I was shot 6 times. He said, my daddy was doing 30 some years in prison. My mom lost her job and I got on the street. I joined the gang. I started hustling. He was like, because we was living in a hotel and I had a little sister. My mama couldn't provide for us, and she would never tell me when we were struggling. He said, but I knew we were struggling, right? And he said, that is when I activated to do what, you know, my friends was doing on the street. Yes. And now he's thinking back on that because now his sisters, his younger sisters, that same sister is preparing to go to college. So, and he has a daughter, and he expresses it. When I was younger, my mama fell off. My dad was locked up. So I activated. I didn't know nothing else. Like, by this time, I had already gotten in trouble. I had been in alternative school, and he's super smart. But he didn't have that, like, support. He didn't have no one to ask him because mama was trying to survive. You get it? Like,
Single mom, just trying to make it.
Yeah, so we have to go back to the parent and say, hey, what's happening? How can I support you? When the mama tell you I'm tired, I can't, tell me what do you need? What are you tired of? Tell me, don't BS me. Tell me the truth so that we know how to support you because we get tired. As a leader, I get tired. I'm still human. I still have to be a mama.
Right.
So we always have to go back to the parent. And sometimes they wasn't shown what they need to be shown because of their mother and their grandparents and their great grandparents. So it's a generational thing, right? Mm-hmm. So even with, I'm very transparent, even with my upbringing, right? My mother was raised by a mother who had 18 kids and a mother who put her out in the storm with her kids and she had to learn how to survive, even though her daddy, my great, great grandfather, right? Was a business owner in Lancaster, South Carolina. He owned a store. He owned a transitional living space. He took care of the family. So this is how we learned, even though, you know, it ain't been great, he had to stick together. But my mama had to learn to be a single mama after my dad passed. So my brother's behavior stems from that. He's incarcerated. I'm very transparent. Right. It stems from that. Right. No, so if anybody, I was too young, if anybody came and checked on my mom at that time, she had to survive. She was a housewife. She had to figure out how to survive after my dad, who was the provider, left, right? She had to get back into the workforce, whatever, you know? So it stems from home. Something is happening or living. Grandma raising me. Grandma can't raise nobody these days. Like,
and as we know, we have a lot of grandmothers.
Yeah, they're our caregivers.
They're our caregivers. A lot of grandmothers that are caregivers. And I think that goes back into, even if we have some educators that are listening right now, what their roles may be, right?
Yep.
John Doe, Jane Doe, when they come to school, their attitude may not truly be directed to you.
Exactly.
It may be all the things they've dealt with, seen and unforeseen in their environment. And they come to school just trying to figure it out, right?
Yep.
So their attitude may not be the best on that day. They may be tired. They their behaviors may be out of control. But it's about wrapping these services around and getting this child to understand, right? And I think you said something too that's also very important. You may not be able to save all.
That's
right. It's about making an effort to save some.
That's right.
Right.
And it, and I want to say this, interject a bit. So for the educators, right, before you make the decision to suspend a student, find out what happened at home before they got there. They might have got a whooping before they came. They might have missed the bus. They might have woke up late. The mama might have been yelling because she was frustrated. Or daddy might have been beating on the mama, anything. Before you make the decision to suspend them, and even if they don't respond to you, right, call in some of them coaches, right, that they respond to. Call in some of them people in the community that they do respond to. Allow them to come in, bring them in to find out what's happening. Don't just suspend them from school and you don't know what's happening.
You know, I'm going to shift gears just a tad bit, right? Because I want to interject myself for a second. So here I was, a child that moved to West Virginia, 8 years old, moved here, had lost both parents, father at three. My father was murdered, I remember. My mother was murdered when I was eight. And so I came very trauma-induced, right? So when you look at the ACEs, I was there, right?
Yes.
But I hid a lot that a lot of people didn't know that. But what I had on me often was my defense mechanism.
That's
what
right.
I had on me was my attitude.
Yep.
Right? It was my best friend. What I had on me was my hobby of fighting. Right? That's what I had to use as my coping mechanism because I didn't know any other way.
That's right.
Now, I say all that to say, even though I had those things, I still was in a home of loving parents, right? And I say parents because I moved into a home that those whom I lived with were my parents at that time and my siblings. But I still was coming into school with all the other things.
Exactly.
All the other trauma.
Influencers and factors and everything, as we would call them.
Right. And I remember very specifically, I had this teacher in fifth grade. She was a Black teacher, first Black teacher I'd ever had. And I thought, this woman does not like me. She's mean. She's angry. And it seemed like she was always against every African-American student that was in the class. And I remember one day she said, tomorrow morning, meet me at the front of the school and we're going to fight. Well, what she didn't know is that Keisha loved to fight. Like, that was my hobby. Let's go, right? Nobody in my house knew. I woke up that morning. I was ready. I got to school and I met her. And I remember she was about to hit me and I said, I wish you would, right? So I say that to say what she didn't know at that time was that I was an angry kid because of my past. I was an angry kid because of my trajectory. I was an angry kid for things that were out of my control, but became part of my life. And I say that because as we look at individuals who are just as involved individuals, you made a point. Not everybody is waking up saying, I want to be a part of the criminal justice system. Not everyone is waking up one day saying, I want to mess up my life and get high and become an addict. Not everyone is waking up saying that. But because of those circumstances, there lies problems that are faced in our community that sometimes our community don't know how to deal with, don't know how to address, and don't know how to provide services for. And so I say that because I want to thank you for all the work that you're doing, because I know that you're not only doing work in North Carolina, I know that you do a lot of work here in West Virginia. I do want you to talk about that. So not only are you a native of West Virginia, but you've come back to where you came from to provide for those who still need a voice here in this area. So if you don't mind sharing as we get ready to close out what you're doing here in West Virginia, and if there's anyone that can assist you in this area, what help do you need from us here in West Virginia to continue to do the work that you are doing on a day-to-day basis?
Thank you for that. So we partner strongly with Liberty Baptist Church. They provide us space for our closet. So our clothing closet thrives very well there because it goes hand in hand when they hand out their food boxes Every other week there at Liberty Baptist Church on Lewis Street in Charleston, West Virginia. They also have a space in Beckley, West Virginia as well. And they allow us to house our closet there. They actually, Pastor Staples and his family and his first lady, they will drive down here and bring, when we have overage here, they'll take it back to West Virginia and get it out to the community. So I am grateful for them and their partnership. Our goal is to come bring our workforce development trainings there and provide it to those there who may need it. We need a space. If we get at least 10 people, we will come once a month and provide those trainings. We provide soft skills, career coaching, resume writing, mock interviewing, and job search strategies. So if anybody there who would like for us to come, we will come once a month and do those for at least 10 or more people. And we would like to partner with the workforce board there, American, the job centers, and anybody else who's doing the work. We are open to that. As long as you're doing the work and you're consistent, we would be happy to partner. And we would need volunteers, individuals who just want to volunteer. We could train you on what to do. We have a resume platform that is very user-friendly that we use for our job seekers to help develop their resumes. So if it's someone who would like to volunteer or interested in us bringing that there, that is the goal for this year, 2025, because I feel like there's a gap there in our hometown. And it would be unjust for me to come learn all of this, right, and not bring it back to my hometown. It's an unjust, and I don't want to be that person. So we are open to that. We need volunteers. And if you want to donate, or if you want to go volunteer to keep that closet organized for Pastor Staples and his congregation, they do an excellent job, but they can always use an extra hand. People in Beckley, people in Charleston, if there's a space there that someone wants the closet to live there, let us know. We don't mind. We have a whole unit here in Charlotte where we can easily transition. But our goal is to bring our workforce development services there and provide it specifically for those who are formerly incarcerated, who needs those skills and that service.
And I know that you do have some board members that are locally here in the area that's feet on the boots on the ground as well. Is that correct?
Yes, okay. We do. We do.
All right. But just for the sake of being able to directly contact Ms. Banks, I've placed a number on the screen, but for those who will be listening from the audio, again, Erica's Closet's number is 704-919-0894. And I've heard Danielle do a call of action, right? She's done a call of action saying that she would love to bring her services here. She's ready to bring her services here in West Virginia, but she need us to be able to make sure that feet continue to be on the ground to help those at times who feel that they have no other help at all. When they come out of the system, they still need wraparound services. And so, as always, I want to thank our listeners today for taking time out of your day, taking time out of your evening to become more educated, to talk about a topic that is uncomfortable at times, because sometimes we all can be a little bit judgmental. Sometimes we all have been a little bit judgmental, but the way that we change an opportunity to stop being judgmental is to be educated. I want to thank you for being very transparent about who you are, not only personally, but who you are to those who are in moments and who are in the trenches of feeling like they have no one else to turn to. So thank you. Thank your staff. Thank Erica's Closet. Thank you, listeners, for taking your time out again to listen to Heart with Keisha B.
So our email is info, I-N-F-O, at Erica's, Erikas-Closet, closet.org. Our website is Erica's, Erikas-Closet, closet.org.
So as always, thank you all once again for listening to Heart with Keisha B. I want to ask you to move over to YouTube, look for Heart to Heart with Keisha B. Push that like button, subscribe so that you can be notified. Again, on Sundays, we have live bonus episodes, but every Wednesday at 8 o'clock a.m. will be a episode that will, again, talk about grief healing and overcoming unforeseen circumstances. So I hope that you all will continue to follow. I hope that you all will continue to share, educate, inspire, and uplift each and every one of us here in our communities. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to Heart to Heart with Keisha B. Remember, grief may shape our journey, but it doesn't define who we are. Healing is not a straight path, but with every step forward, you're creating space for hope, strength, and new beginnings. If today's episode brought you comfort or clarity, share it with someone who might need it too. Let's continue building this community of compassion and resilience together. Until next time, take care of your heart, your mind, and your soul. Honor your journey and always know that brighter days are ahead. I am Keisha B, and this has been Heart to Heart.